Hey, everybody, welcome. Really glad that you're a part of Christ Community Chapel. Welcome those of you over in East Hall, those of you tuning in, welcome. Hey, before I forget, I wanted to thank you for last weekend. You guys did great with buying gifts from our ministry partners, and we call that they've been gifted where we have our ministry partners out in the atrium, and then you guys go out, and it's kind of our way of trying to redeem the whole consumerism of Christmas. Because, you know, if you're like me, sometimes I get tired of the whole advertising and all that. It seems like it's taken over Christmas, but you can't not give gifts. Otherwise, you seem like a Scrooge. So what we do is have these ministry partners make things that you then buy, and then your gift has value, not just to the in giving your money to a ministry partner, but also in the gift that you give and trying to explain where it came from and why you gave your loved one that particular gift. But you guys bought 2,500 gifts last weekend. That's huge, yeah. Thanks. It's funny, every service people applaud, but they're not sure if they should applaud for their consumerism or not. Is that good or not? I guess over $30,000 went directly to our ministry partners. So thanks so much. Yeah, that's good. And now we are blanketing this area and this month with 10,000 acts of kindness and generosity done to perfect strangers. And we're doing it just because. And we want you to grab some of these cards and do something kind or generous to a perfect stranger. And what we're finding as the stories come in to our website from people who have been gifted, that there's a natural kind of reaction to that. People want to pay it forward. They want to do something kind for someone else. So you never know how many, how far that's going to go. But let me read you three stories that came in this week. This is Shirley from Bedford. Just because I see smiles on the veterans' faces in the VA hospice floor in the Cleveland facility, I go there once a week and hold a hand, sit and talk. Make four homemade pies once a month. I'm so blessed and get much more than I give. I also do a bingo once a month on the locked ward with homemade bakery too. This one is from Jessica in Cleveland. I clean office buildings and I'm having a typical rough Monday morning. I was just given a just because card along with a thank you card and generous tip in appreciation of all I do. I didn't even think anyone noticed. Thanks so much to Kelsey for making my day better and helping me see there are still good people in the world. The world needs more love and I can't wait to pay it forward. And then this one, I love this one. This is from Kara in Cuyahoga Falls. Thank you to the couple who bought my 81-year-old dad a movie ticket. He was taken back by this act of kindness. We've been praying for his salvation for years. He kept the card to do something nice for someone else. I was able to let him know our church was the one that was doing this. Isn't that cool? So you never know who you're gifting. So go out there, have a blast, and do something great for someone else. All right? Well, counting this weekend, it's three weekends to Christmas. And I'm going to do a three-week series on Jesus. And normally, I do a series on Jesus in the month of December, but I usually focus the series on the birth narratives found in Matthew or Luke. But I'm going to do something different this year. I'm going to focus on something Jesus says about himself in Matthew chapter 12. In Matthew chapter 12, people are wondering who Jesus is and what he's about. And in response, Jesus compares himself to three different things. Actually, one thing and two people in answer to the question, who are you and what are you here for? So turn to Matthew chapter 12. I'm going to read the first eight verses and then skip to verse 38 and read it to verse 42. This is what it says. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." He said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which it was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests. Or have you not read in the law how on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are guiltless I tell you, something greater than the temple is here. And if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless, for the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Now skipping to verse 38. Then some of the scribes and Pharisees answered him, saying, Teacher, we wish to see a sign from you. And he answered them, An evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and behold, something greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, something greater than Solomon is here. Okay, this is God's word. When asked the question, kind of, who are you? What are you about? Jesus answers by comparing himself to these three things. He says, you guys love the temple, but I want you to know something greater than the temple is here. You love the story of Jonah, but you need to know something greater than Jonah is here. You love the wisdom and the wealth of Solomon, but something greater than Solomon is here. Not surprisingly, I'm calling this series Greater Than. Something greater than. You know, whenever you talk about something being greater than what you have, what you're saying is that what you have is not good enough, that there's something better out there. This is a picture of my phone. When you look at the little apps icon, you see the number 11. Those are 11 updates that are waiting for me to kind of click. I don't know if you do this or not. I don't automatically upgrade my phone. And the reason, there are a couple reasons actually. One is I kind of like the way things are working right now. And sometimes when you upgrade it, it can mess things up. Now, I do upgrade when something stops working. And I look at my phone and I think, man, that's not working the way it's supposed to work. And then I check my updates and sure enough, I need to update something. And then I get the next best thing and then that makes it work. So that's why I upgrade. But the other reason I don't upgrade is because some upgrades aren't upgrades. Some upgrades actually make things worse. And I think that's the way some people think about Jesus. You may think about Jesus like that, where you've heard people talk about Jesus and you're here to listen to Jesus, but you're really not sure because you kind of like the way your life's working now. But there might be something that's going wrong in your life. Your life's not working and you're looking for something better than what you have, which is why you're even looking at Jesus. But then you're afraid that maybe Jesus won't be an upgrade after all. And people in Jesus' time felt the same way. And Jesus wasn't claiming to be a little bit of an upgrade. Jesus was claiming to be a massive upgrade. And let's look at what the very first thing he claims to be an upgrade of, and this is what we're going to focus on today. This is verse 6. He says, I tell you, something greater than the temple is here. Something greater than the temple is here. What a weird thing to say, to claim to be greater than a building. You know, if I told you that I am greater than the Pentagon, you'd have to know something about the Pentagon to even understand what I was claiming to be. So let me tell you something about the temple. The temple was built by King Solomon back in 960 BC. And the temple actually took the place of what was called the tabernacle. The tabernacle is a big word for tent. It was a big tent. Because when the people of Israel came out of Egypt, they were nomads, and they were wandering around, and every place they set up camp, they would set up this big tent right in the middle of the camp, and that was God's tent, and it was a visible reminder that God was with them, a visible reminder of the presence of God. The first upgrade, by the way, is right there. Here at Christmas, we sing a lot about Emmanuel. That was a name given to Jesus, Emmanuel, literally meaning God with us. What is better than a visible reminder of the presence of God? God himself. To be right with you, right where you are. But the people of Israel eventually settled into their country and they built permanent houses instead of having tents, so they wanted to build something permanent for God. And David, King David, had amassed a tremendous amount of wealth, and then King Solomon, his son, built the temple. And the temple was supposed to do the same thing, was to be a visible reminder of the presence of God, but it was supposed to be magnificent, and it was. It wasn't magnificence in its size. It was not even close to being the size of this campus at Hudson. But it was magnificent because it was supposed to reflect something of the glory and the beauty and the majesty of God himself. In 2 Chronicles, you can read all about the details of the building of the temple, but let me just give you some stuff so you'll know. It took 183,000 workers 7 years to build the temple. Okay, let me say that again. 183,000 workers 7 years to build the temple. Now, I know they didn't have power tools, but that's still a lot of labor, all right? They used 25 tons of gold in the temple. That's 50,000 pounds of pure gold. I tried to look up on the internet what the cost would be in today's dollars to build the temple. And the low estimate was between $3 and $6 billion, with a B. Now, to put that into some kind of perspective, the Taj Mahal, which is also a magnificent building, would cost in today's dollars about $750 million. So you could build 6 or 7 Taj Mahals for the price of one temple. So great was the temple, all right? Now, the temple was different than the Taj Mahal, and the Taj Mahal was built as a mausoleum by the emperor in honor of his favorite wife. But the temple actually had a function, and the function had to do with its architecture. So let me explain some about the architecture and then the function of the temple. The temple was built in 3 major sections. There was a section for normal people, like out where you're sitting right now, and that was the largest section. And then there was a separation, like a wall, and it started another section, which was a smaller section called the Holy Place, and that was for priests only. So if you were not a priest, you couldn't come past this barrier right here. And then past the priest section, the Holy Place, there was this huge curtain, not unlike the curtain that's behind us here, but it was massive. It was like... It was as thick as a man's outstretched hand. So I want you to imagine it was made of tightly woven wool this thick. And it would, so you can, if you can imagine like a sweater that thick and how heavy that would be, it actually took several hundred men to adjust the temple curtain even a little bit. It was made of a patchwork, kind of like a quilt. So it wasn't a single seam that ran down. I think there were 64 different sections of the temple curtain so that they could repair it without ever taking it down. And that was important, all right? So all this was, the architecture was for the function, and the function of the temple, there were really 3 important parts to the function of the temple. There was the priest, the sacrifice, and the mercy seat. The priest, the sacrifice, and the mercy seat. And I think that's what Jesus was talking about when he told them, you love the temple, something greater than the temple is here. Okay, let's look at the priest first. A priest was a go-between, a mediator between the normal person and God. And so if you were a normal person and you wanted to bring an offering to God, let's say a sin offering or a guilt offering or a thanksgiving offering, you had to go through a priest. So priests acted a little bit like butlers. So you would come, let's say if this is the temple, you'd be sitting out there, you want to bring something to God. You would come to the front here, you would knock on the door. Somebody like me, let's say I'm a priest, I open the door and I say, can I help you? And you say, yeah, I want to give this to God. Can you make sure he gets it? And then I say, okay, and I take what you give and I close the door. And you stand there, and you may say a prayer or something like that, and then you walk away. And that's the way it worked. There was always a mediator. And so the priests were also normal people. So they had to also be making sacrifices and giving offerings to God. But there was one priest that was special, and he was called the high priest. And the high priest was the only one, and he could only do this once a year, but could actually go past the massive curtain into that place, the little small room called the Holy of Holies. And in that small room called the Holy of Holies, it was richly, like, appointed, but in the middle of it, there would be a box that was called the Ark of the Covenant. It was about the size of a toy box or a cedar chest, let's say this big. And it had a special lid for it. And on the lid, there were two angels that were facing each other made of, there were sculptures of angels made of solid gold. Oh, and the Ark of the Covenant was covered with gold too. That's where some of the 25 tons of gold went. And these angels, oh, they were called cherubim. They would be facing each other and their wings would be outstretched and they would have their heads down and their wings would actually touch each other and it would form like a canopy over the box or the Ark of the Covenant. And underneath the canopy and on top of the box, there was a bowl like this. And that was called the mercy seat. In Hebrew, it was called the Kaporet. And if you translated it into Latin, it was called the propitiatorium, because it was here that propitiation would be made. Now, propitiation is a word that we don't use very often. You probably didn't use it this week. And so let me explain. This is the easiest way for me to explain propitiation. If you have a five-year-old son and he disobeys you, and you put him in timeout. You say you're going to be in timeout, and then when he has finished his sentence in timeout, you say, okay, son, you can come here. And he comes to you, and you say, tell me what you did. And he looks at you, and he says, Dad, I disobeyed you. And you say, what else do you want to say? And he says, I'm sorry. And then you reach out, and you hold him, and you hug him. That means propitiation has taken place. Because your rightful anger at his disobedience has been set aside. And your relationship with him has been restored. That's propitiation. So the mercy seat was called a propitiatorium because that's where propitiation would take place for normal people and God. And this is how it would happen. Once a year, the high priest was able to go behind the curtain. And that day was called Yom Kippur, or the Day of Atonement, literally the Day of Blood. And what would happen on the Day of Atonement is that the high priest would start out the day and he would first scrub himself like a surgeon preparing for surgery. You know how a surgeon is like scrubbing his hands like that, or scrubbing her hands? That's the way the high priest would do all over his body so that every speck of dirt, every stain would be wiped off. And he would be as clean as a human being could possibly get. And then they would put a brand new like linen robe on him. And he would then be ready. And they would bring him two animals. And there'd be two goats. And he would take the one goat and he would place his right hand on the head of that goat, and then he would confess the sins of the people for that year. And that would take a while. And after he finished confessing all the sins, they would take that goat and they would lead that goat out of the city gate, and they would kind of push it out of the city and shoo it away. So it would wander off away from the people. And that was called the scapegoat, which is where that term comes from. Because when the high priest would put his hand on the head, he was symbolically transferring the sins of the people for that year onto that goat. And then the goat would be shooed away, and the sins of the people would be symbolically moved away from them. Then he would take the other goat, and they would sacrifice the other goat. And he would capture the blood of the other goat in a bowl. And then he would take that and he would walk past the massive curtain into the Holy of Holies, and we would walk up to the Ark of the Covenant underneath the canopy of the cherubim, and he would take that bowl and he would pour that blood onto the mercy seat and into that bowl on top of the Ark of the Covenant. And when he would emerge out of that room, the people, all the people that would be gathered, would know that their sins for that whole year had been covered and propitiation had been made. And for that moment, they would feel like their relationship with God was whole. And they would feel like a relief and a freedom. And then they would turn around and they would go back to their lives, to their marriages, to their jobs, to their children, to their frustrations, to their temptations, and it would start all over again. That was the temple. Jesus shook people up in Matthew chapter 12 when he said, as great as the temple is, as much as you love the temple, and it was the only way that the Jewish people ever understood how they could ever be whole with God, even for a moment, Jesus said, something greater than the temple is here. One of the things that I think is true about God is that he loves patterns. I mean, there are things that are made in patterns over and over again so that the truth is going to be unmistakable. When we get to heaven, I think we're going to see how he weaved truth into every part of our experience here on earth. I think the seasons themselves are a pattern. A winter, spring, summer, and fall. It's a pattern not just of the human kind of lifespan of how we go through life, but it's also a pattern, I think, of something that happened in heaven. It's not a coincidence that Jesus' resurrection happens in the spring when the entire earth, which has been dead through the winter, explodes into life. It happened like that because God made the seasons as a pattern of something that was a deeper eternal truth, which was going to be the resurrection of Jesus. When God compares himself to a relationship here on earth where he says, I am like a shepherd and you are like sheep, he's talking about a pattern. You know, sheep many times, I think, would go through their lives and not pay attention to the shepherd at all. And they would think, oh yeah, I'm finding this grass. You know, their heads are down. They're eating grass. They're going, hey, I'm finding all this grass on my own. This is great. And they don't realize how much the shepherd is doing every moment to watch over them and care for them. And God is saying, that is a pattern of the way you treat me and the way I treat you. I'm like a shepherd and you're like a sheep. So when God makes things in patterns, I think the temple itself was a pattern, and the function of the temple was a pattern. When you read in 2 Chronicles about all the details of the temple, God gives very specific ways to build the temple, to build the tabernacle. He's doing that because later on we find out that that is a replica of something that was in heaven, of a real temple, a real place up in heaven. And this was just this replica of it. But then the function is a pattern. Because every human being needs someone, a mediator between them and God, to teach us how we can even approach a holy God. Every human being needs a sacrifice, something to pay for our failures and our guilt and our shame. And every human being needs some kind of response, some kind of assurance that we have been restored to God and that God doesn't hate us, but instead God loves us. This is the way the writer to the Hebrews says it in Hebrews chapter 9. Beginning of verse 1, it says, now even the first covenant had regulations for worship and an earthly place for holiness, for a tent was prepared, the first section in which were the lampstand and the table and the bread of the presence. It was called the holy place. Behind the second curtain was a second section called the most holy place, having the golden altar of incense and the ark of the covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden urn holding the manna and Aaron's staff that budded and the tablets of the covenant. Above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these things we cannot now speak in detail. That's what I just told you about how the temple was set up. And then verse 11. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is not of this creation. He's talking about something in heaven. He entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the sprinkling of defiled persons with the ashes of a heifer sanctify for the purification of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God? I had not realized this until I started to study for this message. But when Jesus was crucified, a lot happened all in the moment that he died. Jesus was crucified outside of the city gates. Actually, he was outside of the city, right where they would shoo that scapegoat, where they would say, you know, the sins are going to be taken away. So that's where Jesus was crucified. The moment that Jesus died on the cross, a few things happened. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It became pitch black, black as midnight. And then there was an earthquake that shook the entire area. But inside the city gates, both Matthew and the Gospel of Mark tell us something very strange happened in the temple. The massive curtain at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that massive curtain that was as thick as a man's hand, made of tightly woven wool without a seam, was split from top to bottom and splayed open. And I think the reason that happened is that happened the moment that Jesus died and he entered into heaven, into that place where the real mercy seat is, and he took his own blood and he poured it onto the mercy seat of God. And at that moment, the curtain tore in two. Because what the curtain did was it separated the holy God from normal people because of sin. And what happened when Jesus poured his blood on the mercy seat was propitiation. And it was propitiation not just for a year of sin. It was propitiation for sin for not just a lifetime, but forever. Jesus says to the people, "You love the temple. There is something greater than the temple here." Here's what the writer of the Hebrews says in Hebrews chapter 4. "Since then we have such a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who's unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need." For the first time after Jesus was crucified was when people like you, people like me, could go to the throne of God and not quake in fear because of his wrath, but we could run to the throne because it became a throne of grace for us. And he became a father to you and to me. Now here's the question. How do you deal with your own failure? How do you deal with your guilt and your shame and your sin? There are different ways that people deal with that. Some people deal with it by going, "You know what? I know I haven't been perfect, but look at all the good that I do now. I'm trying to turn over a new leaf. I'm doing the best I can." That's one way to try to deal with it. There are other people who deal with it by comparing themselves to other people. And they say, "Well, okay, yeah, I've done some things that are wrong, but at least I'm not as bad as he is. At least I'm not as bad as she is." Listen, if that's you, I just want you to know there's something greater than that. You need an upgrade on how you deal with your sin, with your guilt, and with your shame. And that's Jesus. Jesus was the perfect high priest. He was the perfect sacrifice. His blood poured out for you, paid for your sin, not just for a year, not just for a lifetime, but forever. Do you know this Jesus? This Christmas, do not celebrate this Christmas without knowing the one who came for you, the one who is greater than all your sin. Would you pray with me? Father in heaven, thanks for your deep love for us that has never been expressed quite like you did when you sent us Jesus. Thank you for the temple. Thanks for that whole pattern. But thank you most of all that you gave us something greater than the temple. A perfect high priest, a perfect sacrifice, and mercy. Mercy that is greater than all of our sin. Thanks for Jesus. We pray this in his name. Amen.